Slimy Boogerman. Dark Zero. Nearest Airport. These are all teams that Anderson underscore Val has been a part of. And today we're talking to him about how his approach has changed and improved Nearest Airport, allowing them to defeat teams like A-Crew and T1 at the NSG Summer Final Cup. I'm Ian St. Lawrence, the executive producer of Valorantine, and today we're talking about the man who controls the vibes, who makes sure that people are on point, and is really quite a smart dude, Anderson Val.
Okay, so my name is Andy Collins, but in the Valorant gamertag, my alias is Anderson. I am a former professional player for Dark Zero Esports, and I have had a very, very good past couple of months with my free agent team, Nearest Airport.
Awesome. Now, I was going through old tweets and stuff, and it looks like, from what I could tell, you played CSGO fairly seriously. I saw something about maybe being an MDL. Was CSGO your first, like, I'm really trying to be competitive in a esport or game, or is there even more history to your competitiveness in video games?
It actually, there's a deeper history with it. I've been a very competitive, I guess, I think that's fairly normal for a lot of people who are in esports, where we were very competitive as kids. It started back when I used to play RTS called Total Annihilation with my father. It was released in 1997, and he and I used to play that all the time when I was growing up. And every time my dad, I was 6 or 7 years old, and my dad would just destroy me. Like, he would do the type of father thing where he'd let you win, and then he'd be like, I'm the real one who knows this, and he'd absolutely kill me. And as I got older, I started figuring out my dad's own strategies, until to the point where one day I just destroyed him, and the look on his face when it was all over, he was just like, what the heck? And then PS2 games, there's an old 007 James Bond game from 2003, 2004, and there was a golden gun. And my dad will tell the story where when I first started it, he would win and it would be great. And then as time went on, I would just be one-shotting him. I would be killing him across the map, and he would get more and more frustrated. And then that slowly turned into Call of Duty and COD 4, playing that. And then I think back in 2013, I had a friend who was like, hey, we should totally play Counter-Strike. It'd be such a fun time. And unfortunately, his life was saved and my life just became ruined with how many hours I put into that game. And that kind of divulged the competitive part. I loved the ranking system. I loved being able to be oh, I'm global elite. I'm a part of the 0.1% of all players. And then I found out that there was a whole nother branch, and I found ESEA. And then I found the whole pro scene of Counter-Strike. I started watching all the pro matches. I was following Cloud9 at the time, Elevate, even Area 51, a lot of CS 1.6 teams that eventually transitioned to Go. And then I took my competition towards that. And so forth.
Is it safe to say then that your first team FPS competitive experience was with COD 4 or James Bond, or would you say that's CSGO?
I'd say the closest to professional was CSGO. There was always a bunch of I joined a couple clans back in the day, where we'd run our pro mods, and we thought we were good, but we were terrible. I think the real time where I started taking things serious was in CSGO, and it actually has reference to do with the guards coach, MCE. MCE took me to one of my first LANs where I actually played with him, and I played with Optics Yeaster back in 2015, 2016.
That's amazing. that's really cool. Okay, so now if I understand correctly, obviously there is, you weren't really part of teams beginning in Valorant, but it seems like one of the first set players that you were playing with was CF Brando, Aaron, Pure Red and Thrifo. Is that correct? Or was there an earlier iteration of you competing in like open tournaments for Valorant?
There was. It gets a little complicated though, because I was playing, the original roster was me, Stronglegs, Thwifo, Pure R, and then a guy named Hunter from Counter-Strike. Hunter was a really notorious opper. That was our first initial roster. And as tournaments went on and as time went on, we ended up leaving a couple of players behind. And then it was me, Thwifo, and Pure R. And we picked up Brando and Aaron. And that was like the first iteration of the Pretty Boys that eventually became Xset. And that was my like that was my real first team competing in North America Valorant. And I believe, or yeah, sorry, I realized that was the question.
No, that's fine. You can go off on whatever tangent you want. No worries. Like I said, it's all going to be edited anyway. So, yeah, don't be self-conscious about that. But when you look back on one of those early iterations of teams that you were part of for Valorant, what do you like? Is there something that you really see that's affecting you to this day, besides maybe like some of the persisting friendships, but more of like, what do you see from that kind of has molded you into the player you are now, if anything? Or was everything you were doing back then a huge mistake and all you've done is learn from it and now you're much better?
A mix of both. I would say with every team that I've joined, there's bits and pieces that I've been taking and kind of like reevaluating everything that we did on those teams. Because I think if we were to take... if you were to take all the top teams with the knowledge that they have now and throw them back to like 2 years ago, the scene would look completely different. The teams that were on the top would not be on the top. The dominance of team play would reign supreme over kind of like the Puggier style. But I think that's because all of the top teams in the beginning were Counter-Strike players or Overwatch players. They were aimers. So the tactical in-depth of all the utility and the strategy wasn't there yet. So like you see Sentinels, like Tens would just swing it. Everything, and he would just win his fights, and Sentinels reign supreme. And now I think the game is a lot more tactical, it's a lot more team orientated, and it's a lot more selfless. So my development as a player from starting like on Pretty Boys, I was a lot more selfish. My comms weren't as clean as they are now. My proactive thinking wasn't there, because now when I play Valorant, I'm looking for, okay, well, what are they throwing? What characters are where? What info are they throwing out early? What do their ultimates look like? Like, you're running these calculations of every possible scenario. But in the beginning, it was like, oh, Omen's here. Or this person's here. They threw this. But you're not really proactively thinking about how you can use those information to help you win future rounds. You're, like, really in and focused on the first, like, the round that you are currently in. And there was combos that everybody thought were like mind-blowing that happened regularly in matches today. I think one of the big ones was from October, I think, of 2020. And it was when Moon Raccoons used a Sova ult and a Brim ult on Seaside Haven. And everybody was like, oh my gosh, it's amazing. And like no one thought of that. And now you see those combos regularly happen. Or there's even more utility being thrown. But that's like normal now. So I think when I talk about like my experience as a player, there are certain things that I think I did correct, but there's a lot of things that I think I did wrong. And it's my ability to grow as a player is being able to evaluate all the things I did right and make those better and make all the things that I did wrong, like get rid of all the like bad habits, the bad communication, realizing that there's so much that I need to learn and there's so much that I'm still learning. And I think that's probably the biggest difference from me back then and me now is I probably thought I knew more back then than I do. And now I realize that I know less. I know so much less. And there's so much more to learn about the game and just every aspect of team play there is imaginable.
Was the complexity and the, you know, combos or the mixing and matching of utility and the different characters, agents, was that something that, was that a reason that it drew you out of CSGO and into Valorant? Or was it a little bit more like, shiny new game, let's try it out, and then it stuck with you, or something totally different?
A little bit of that. In the nicest way possible, because it is a little slandering. Purar and I are, I'm just going to call him Bryce from here on out. Purar and I are really good friends. Bryce and I played CSGO MDL for a couple seasons together. And we played the game, I think, to, like, we played on the same team in CSGO for like a year and a half. And we tried to compete, and getting pro at this point in NACS was almost impossible. I think you had a one relegation season every three seasons. And on top of that, only one team would make it up. So your chances of really hitting the professional was one, you either get poached for being extremely talented, such as Grimm, who now plays for Liquid, and or you had an amazing run, or just you basically needed the miracle run. And the odds of that happening were very slim. So I was actually working full-time as a software developer, and I was just pugging out MDL with Bryce and our squad for fun because it was enjoyable. It was a way I got to interact with the homies. I think COVID just started, so everybody was playing games. So when Valorant first got released, I played the beta with my friends, and we didn't really take it, like, serious. We were like, oh, it's a Riot base. Like, we'll see. Like, let's just play. We hit Radiant. We had some fun, and then that was kind of it. It wasn't until Immortals announced their first roster with players that, one, we never heard of before, and players that we felt we were better than in CS. And when we saw those players getting signed, we're like, wait a second. This is possible. Because Immortals in CS was a tier one org. That was a professional level org. So when we saw Immortals do that to Valorant and just pick up, I think it was like they picked up Kohler, they picked up Bjor, they picked up JC Stanny, and we were like, Bryce and I were like, we could be as good as those players. I mean, I think we're like, again, you're going to have the ego, but we were like, at the time, we were like, we are better than a couple of these players in CS. So we're like, we could definitely do this. And that was when we made the entry. Because I was like, being a professional gamer was always one of my dreams. But the longer I played in CS, and now having a lot of this experience now, I understand why I never went pro. I know the flaws that I had that I needed to work on. But I always wanted to do it, and seeing Valorant throw all of this, all the orgs throw in all their support for this fresh talent and this new game on their race to make the top, it was achievable. And that was a risk that he and I were both like ready to make. We were like, okay, let's commit. Let's do an entire year. Let's try to do this for a year. And if at the end of the year we don't make it, then we're done. And that's it. Luckily we both had our breaks, but that was kind of our thought process towards it.
When you look back at those old teams and then your stint with Dark Zero and then obviously your current success with Nearest Airport, were you in a leadership position with those old teams? And if not, like, are you in a leadership position now? And what does that feel like? And what has been the evolution of that for yourself?
So when I first started this with Pretty Boys, I was on the sidelines, and with Slimy Boogerman, I was more affirmative, but I didn't want the leadership role. Then with Kuki Koalas, people looked up to me to be the leader, but I didn't want it. And I didn't want it because of the full-time job I was working. I couldn't handle all of the responsibility of doing a 9-to-5, and then you're practicing from 5 to 11, and then you just go to bed, rinse and repeat, and then you're playing tournaments on the weekends. And that was a lot of pressure to hold the leadership role. So I passed it off to Screwface, and then that's how that ultimately went with DZ. But I've always been kind of nudged in the way of leadership, where they're like, you have the charisma for it, and people generally they'll listen to you if you take that position. You have the trust, basically. So now on Nearest Airport, this will get into more of what I've taken from DZ and how I've kind of like flipped my luck, so to say. But I took the aspects of DZ, all the things that went wrong, and I reevaluated all of it. And I was like, what if I actually had the ability to stop that? Like, to stop the negative parts of what happened on DZ and kind of create a new culture. So when I joined Nearest Airport, I kind of explained what I would want the culture to look like. And I've been put in this leadership position where, for my team specifically now with Nearest Airport, I am the guy who keeps everybody in check. I'm the one who makes sure that, like, are we focusing on the right goals? Are we keeping our tonality correct when talking to each other? Are we going to keep, Are we playing at the level that we should be playing and keeping each other accountable, but in a way where everyone's going to be receptive of said criticism if it's given? Because everybody accepts things differently. And that's kind of the leadership position that I have taken now. And yeah, I would say the entire one has been like a stepping stone where each time I get placed on a team, I have the decision where it's like, okay, I can take over this and we could create, like, I have the ability to create the environment that I want, but I never took that responsibility to create that environment. And with Nearest Airport, it's the first time where I have taken the full authority to create that environment and the culture that cultivates winning.
So obviously you're experiencing right now some great success with Nearest Airport. With that change in your leadership position for that team, is there a part of you that looks back at these previous teams and goes, I kind of wish I had made that change earlier? Or do you think that you couldn't be the leader you are now without those experiences, without seeing other people in leadership positions? And you think, like, this was the perfect time to do this, and I'm seeing the fruits of those labor.
Yeah, it's always hindsight looking at it, because when I first got cut by DZ, it was hard. It was really heavy on my mental, or this is just how I process things. I give myself a time frame. I go, this is gonna suck, but it's gonna, like, I can let it suck for so long, or I could just like man up and, or not man up, I could just move forward and get on with everything that's going on. So I gave myself, I said, okay, this is gonna suck. I'm gonna give myself like 2 days just to be full on sad, to be grieving, to kind of like understand that this could potentially be the end. And then after that, it's time to get to work. And I think that with everything that happened on DZ, I'm grateful for the opportunities, because there's so many things that went wrong, and now there's so many experiences and so many situations that I can prevent from happening on my future teams. Stuff that I probably would let slide if I hadn't had those experiences. So for me, I look at it as it was an amazing opportunity to really grow as an individual and to push forward for whatever is in the future. And being able to see the fruits of the labor put in, as you were saying, is probably one of the greatest rewards. It feels so phenomenally, it feels so amazing to understand that, you know, like, I may be winning for a month and a half, but it took 9 months of literally winning nothing. I had to lose for 9 months straight, lose my job in order for me to finally start to win. And I think,
Sorry, you say lose your job. Did you quit your job, or did you get fired because?
Oh, No. I got the correct terms were I was laid off of DZ.
Oh, for DZ. Sorry, I thought you were talking. So, sorry. Are you still employed full time as a software developer, or did you?
No.
When did you make the decision to stop working, and was that with joining DZ?
Yeah, that was once I officially signed the paper contract, once I officially signed the contract with DZ, I put in my 2 weeks notice at my job. So I was a software dev from 2019 all the way up until 2021.
Gotcha. And then in terms of like leadership and stuff, I'm assuming because you've had a full-time job as a software developer that, you know, you probably also went to college. So I don't know what your age is, but I'm looking mid-20s. I don't know if that's correct. But from what I've seen, a lot of FPS competitive games, younger man's game, a lot of 16 to like 21-year-olds. Do you think that some of those leadership responsibilities kept getting offered to you because you were older and you're just like a little bit more worldly and experienced? Or do you think that you just have some specialized experience either growing up or, you know, other jobs or positions you've held that have like ingrained leadership skills within you?
So I think my parents will argue that as a kid, I was always the one trying to take charge. But I really think it was the mentality I put in through college. So I'm 24, and I did something that not a lot of people, this is me tooting my own horn a little bit, but I did something that a lot of people can't do. And that is, I went to school for 2.5 years straight, and I did 5 semesters each year. And I graduated with my bachelor's when I was 20, and I graduated with my master's when I was 21. And then I immediately started working a week after I graduated with my master's. And I was running an internship all while doing the school. So I've had to deal with a lot of responsibility, especially as a younger adult, where I can count on my hand how many times I went out to a party or how many times I went out to like a bar with friends. Because there wasn't, I didn't do it a lot. I didn't have a lot of free time with everything that I was juggling in my life, especially when you add one of the reasons why I could do so many semesters of college was I played collegiate Counter-Strike. So I actually had a scholarship to play Counter-Strike for a school in Chicago. And that kind of added to it. But when you throw yourself in like a team dynamic such as Valorant, where a lot of it is dominated by younger individuals, a lot of these individuals haven't had real like responsibility. And I mean like they haven't had to. I've been on my own since I was 20, which means I've been fully fi or when I say on my own, I mean financially independent. My parents have not helped me out with anything for the last 4 years, and they are very proud of me for that. But until somebody really has to like deal with paying the rent, paying all of the insurance, paying your own bills fully, and realizing that like you can't just wake up and go, I don't want to work today, because you can't do that. You could develop this mindset of you're always looking to solve problems rather than avoid them. And I think with a younger generation playing a video game, a lot of people like to avoid problems rather than solve them. And that's why I think I've always been handed the, or I've always been pushed into the leadership position, because in this game specifically, you really want problem solvers. You don't want people who are just gonna follow. You don't want followers. You want innovators in this game. You want people who are gonna think outside of the box rather than just look at what everybody else is doing and copy it. So that'd be my little explanation towards that.
No, that makes perfect sense. From a leadership position, if you were given four different players and they all were average across everything except they were exceptional in one thing, and for one player it was they had the best attitude and spirit, always positive, always looking to get better. Another player, they just had godlike mechanics. They were like a tens or something. Another player, they were someone who really led and kept people motivated. Or another player was someone who just like really understood the strategy and tactics of the game. Of those four, if you had to pick one to have on your team, who would you go for? And essentially, what I'm asking with this is, what skill do you think is most important, or what quality do you think is most important in a player? And then the other stuff you can, teach them, or it doesn't have to be there.
Yeah, 100% the person who is open-minded and willing to learn. Here's actually a story to kind of like back this up. So, I was a software developer. I don't have a BS or an MS in anything development related. I was working as a. I actually have mine in computer network and security, and my bachelor or my master's is in data forensics. It has nothing to do with software development. I interned for a virtual reality place as a networking guy, and they threw me a couple programming assignments. And I liked programming. It was something that I really liked, but my scholarship and the school I ended up going to didn't offer as much programming as I would have wanted, but it makes school affordable, so obviously you go and you work with what you got. I finished the programming assignment, so then they gave me another one, and I finished that one, and then they gave me another one, and I kept doing it. And I did them better than the people. And it wasn't just that I did it better, it's that I was asking questions. I was eager to learn. I wanted help. I spent time. I would put overtime into it. So when eventually the work offered me the job, there was other people interning for the software development place, and they gave me the job, somebody who was entirely not qualified. But they gave it to me because they were like, we can teach you anything. You'll put in the time. It doesn't matter what the qualifications are. We have seen that you're willing to put in the work. And time in, time again, I think one of the players on my roster now, we have Expert. Expert has never played in any competitive environment besides this is his first team ever, and he's played ranked the entire time. And this kid is so eager and open to just everything, and he puts in the time. And because of that, you could offer me Asuna, and I don't even know his work ethic. I'd still take Expert. Because your mechanics don't mean shit, if it's part of my language. Your mechanics don't matter to me if you aren't going to show that you're teachable, if you're not going to show that you're willing to put in the work. Because even if he doesn't know the strategy part, he'll learn that. You can explain that to him. He'll take the time to learn it. He'll take the time to develop god mechanics. And I think that's something that a lot of the North America Valorant team has put way too much emphasis on, is everybody likes to watch the flashy player because it's entertaining. But in order to really win, you need teammates who are going to self-sacrifice. Losing or winning requires you to lose. And the best mechanics aren't going to guarantee that you always win. Having the best strategy sometimes doesn't even guarantee that you'll always win. But having the hardest workers, you'll win. May not just be now, but you'll win.
Schlats, Pretty Boys, Mustache Men. Do you have a favorite team name that you guys have played under?
The Hookabunkaloos. The Hookabunkaloos was so good. So I am the troll when it comes to all the names, because for us it's like there's so many prof for me when it comes to naming, there's so many professional orgs in the game already, and there's so many different tournaments that they also participate in. So the biggest way, in my opinion, to get your like free agent team name out there is if you beat these professional teams with just an absurd name. Because imagine like one of the ones when we were the Hunkabunkaloos was it was we beat Space Station, we beat BBG, and we beat Beast Coast. And when people look, they're like, "Oh, who did these guys lose to?" And then they're like, "What? What name is that? Who even is that?" And then people start asking questions. You get the notoriety where they're like, "There's no way these guys are losing to these guys." Same thing with like nearest airport, where everybody jokes around with NA and they're like, "NA means nearest airport." But it's kind of funny when NA is like, "We're taking out T1, we're taking out a crew, we're taking out DZ, we're taking like." When the troll names start to succeed, it's like everybody's gonna instantly recognize that branding with that team because it's the new it's the it's the hottest new hottest commodity with the most absurd name.
When you look back at all those different various team names and everything, excluding like Dark Zero, is there do you have any moments that like kind of clicked for you where you were like, man, I want to play with this player for like the rest of my career? Or I know you already talked about like the Mortal signing being like something that was kind of a click moment where you were like, oh, like we could do this professionally. But has there been any other moments like that where like you were like, holy shit, like, yeah, I should keep doing this, or I think this is the agent for me, or something like that.
Yeah, actually, one of the most recent like click moments I had was something that I think a lot of teams still do, and my guys and myself are trying to completely stop ourselves from doing this. But during when we were playing our match against Gen G, there's a moment of it where there's a lot of pressure on our backs, and obviously, like again, like I have financial obligations, so does everybody else on my team. So we're trying to get signed, and I'm like, okay, if we take out Gen G, and then we're gonna be back, like closer to getting signed, it's gonna look better for us. So I put all of this pressure on everybody, and then somebody slipped up, and it was a really stupid mistake, but it was a mistake due to a miscommunication, and I reacted to it. And then because I reacted to it, and I'm again more of the, let's just say I'm the vibes guy on the team. So I'm the vibes guy, and I reacted to it. Other people on my team started to react to it. And we ended up, like, we just end up losing five, six, seven rounds because we're caught up about something that happened in the past. And it wasn't until we lose that series, and then we have another tournament and we play against Teal Scene, and the same thing happens where we start losing rounds after I react to something. And it clicked, and I was like, we're losing because I'm saying something. We're losing because I'm reacting. And from that, like, I had that moment where I was like, I've reacted on every single other team. Other players on my like other teams also have reacted to stupid mistakes. And then it's just like clicking. I'm like, holy shit, we're losing because we're just talking about like the round prior. We're getting so caught up on something that happened literally the last round that we're no longer thinking about these next ones. So these next tournaments, or the next couple of days, I was like, all right, guys, we're gonna come up with this new system on how we like critique each other. We're gonna follow it. And I just we if anything comes up, you just nice try and we move on. We are not giving it any kind of like we're always gonna make mistakes in games. There's no team that's gonna play perfect, but we just gotta stop like reacting to all of these mistakes that we're making because it affects these rounds. And they all bought into it. And then the next tournament we play in, we get all the way to zero marksman, and then we're playing it, and the same thing happens, but instead of losing seven rounds, we only lose four. And then we reevaluate it and we figure out where it's happening and who was doing it. And we go, hey, this has to stop. This is going to be a problem that's going to destroy us because it destroyed, not going to out people, but there's a lot of people in the scene who do it and there's a lot of teams that do it. So then we reevaluated that again and it clicked. I was like, we're getting closer and closer to beating all these better teams due to the fact that like we still make mistakes. We're not letting it affect us anymore. And then we had our last one where we made mistakes. We made a lot of mistakes, but it was the first time where we didn't throw any rounds due to the mistakes that we made in the like past. We didn't throw any future rounds. And that's been the most like biggest click moment in my head because I've looked at a kind of like replayed all of the like tournaments I played with DZ, all the tournaments like I played with like Slimy Boogerman, Kooky Koalas, and the number one correlation in all of that is the moment we react to mistakes in game, in scrims, we start to clock out and throw rounds out due to the fact that we're no longer focused about winning the next one. That's been my latest kind of like moment where I've been like, oh shoot.
That's awesome. So you've described yourself on Nearest Airport as kind of like the vibes guy, the person who's kind of setting the culture, the person who's in like the leadership position. Are you like officially like the IGL, the coach, or any of these
Actually,
things,
yeah.
or how does that work?
I am not the IGL. Like I said, that's when I talk about the leadership position, I hope it doesn't get misconstrued. Bancroft is the IGL, and he is phenomenal. He is absolutely amazing. When I talk about my leadership position, it's in the setting the culture. I am the one where the tone of the team goes through me. And if I'm not leading by example with what the tone should be, then there's deviations. And it's my job on the team to make sure that our tone is the exact same in practice as it is in matches, as it is each day. And if it falters, we figure out where it's faltering and we talk about it and we make sure that we never do that again and we just keep it consistent. Because when the tone of a team is consistent, they're gonna have much more better of a fighting chance than the tone where you can like this comes into more of the dynamic of the overall team, but when a player is upset, when you practice with your players for so long, you can figure out really quickly if something's bothering somebody, or if some player's upset, or some player's not in it all the way. Even if they say they are, you know they're not in it. So that's been my leadership position, or in my leadership position with, or my leadership role within the team has been to make sure that we are consistently keeping the tone, the environment, the culture the same each day. And make sure that it is a productive environment to be in. Bancroft is the IGL in terms of he is the person who is going to call a default, a strat. He's going to have a call in the beginning of every single round. As it goes for mid-rounding, this is where our team might differ, but we have five mid-rounders. Everybody in our team is constantly thinking about how to adapt in the mid-round, and the system only works because we each trust each other. And sometimes there are disagreements, but again, with my position, I've made sure that all of those, or I'm making sure, because sometimes, again, there are deviations, but I'm making sure that all of those talks or arguments happen in the VOD review and not in the scrims or practice itself. So if a call is made by anybody, we follow through with that call, even if some people don't agree with it. Because 8 times out of 10, it doesn't get brought up in VOD review because it wasn't important. It was just something in the middle where somebody thought their call was right and then they go, oh, it wasn't. But if it really bothers somebody, you just bring it up in VOD review. You bring it up at the end, and then it can become a discussion. So that's where, like, again, we have Bancroft calls, everybody mid-rounds, and it only works because the trust is there, where we're trusting that each person is correct in what they're saying.
Would you feel weird if I called you the general manager?
A little bit.
Because, like, setting culture and structure sounds like you're doing some of that role, which, like, I understand that that's probably not, like, so much your day-to-day relationships with the players, but has anyone ever called you a general manager of Nearest Airport?
No. Because I think because in Valorant specifically, when you think of the general manager, you're thinking of the person who manages the teams, gets persons like signed up. I understand where you're coming from on this, because now that you say it like that, like in layman's terms, if like again, if you were on a developmental team, you'd have like the general manager of your branch or whatever, and they're organizing how everybody's going to work together, and they're making sure that it's a productive environment to be in, that everybody is contributing, and that you're getting the project done. So I understand where you're coming from that. I think in Valorant, the general manager position is the guy who schedules your scrims, gets you signed up for tournaments, make sure that like everybody has what they need. So that I get what you're saying when you say that.
I think if you were to ask DDK, who's the general manager of 100 Thieves, what he does, his answer would be a little similar to the answer of what do you do for Nearest Airport. That's funny.
Yeah. I think that's something that's missing within the culture of Valorant as a whole. I think, like, again, you could have 5 talented players on a team, but if they're all not working together towards the same goal, and even if they think they are, but if they're not doing it the correct way, your results aren't going to be the same. I like to equate it as, you could have 5, let's go with like construction. You could have 5 construction workers, but without the plans, without the proper tools, without the knowledge, without the infrastructure, they're never going to get anything done. Because everyone's going to want to do it like this way or that way, or they're going to want to like deviate and do this stuff. You're going to have so many conflicts of interest. So yeah, I totally get what I understand what you're saying.
Let's rewind. When did Nearest Airport start, and how did it start?
That was actually, it was mostly Profi's project. Profi and Bancroft were building a team, and then Profi just hit up Expert since they used a pug over a year ago. It was primarily those three. And then when I got cut from DZ, I had 2 options. I had probably the worst statistics that I've ever had in the past 6 months of like my personal career. And I could sit there and I could go, you know, I could wait for an opportunity to come to me, which it probably wouldn't due to the fact that I wasn't a wannable player. Or I could just accept the fact that I'm going to have to reprove myself. And I'm on limited money, limited time. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to accept that. So I started looking at who were the free agent teams. And I think there was one with Alexander and one with Profi. And I trialed with both of them. And the one with Alexander, it was just like your typical, it was just like a typical environment. It wasn't bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't terrible. And then I went and I played with Profi. We hadn't even like found Tyler yet, Sim. And I went to go play with Profi and his boys. And I kid you not, we scrimmed some Diamond 3 players. Like, I don't even know what team they were. And they were trying. I don't want to discredit younger talent that's trying to play, but they were trying. And our team with Bank and Profi and Nolan, our expert, they were calming as if we were playing VCT. We're like to equate it, where it's like playing a basketball game against middle schoolers, and we're trying as hard as we were playing another NBA team. It blew my mind, because that is something that you don't see even with many pro teams. A lot of people troll scrims and they don't take it as serious. So when I saw that environment, I was like, all right, I could do good here. So I joined, and we started practicing a little bit more, and that's when I started adapting the culture. I was like, you guys are actually pretty good, but if we're gonna get signed, or if we're gonna get opportunities, we need to come up with kind of a plan or a strategy to get that far. So Bancroft was like, let's just scrim for 2 weeks. Let's build like a 5-map map pool. I think at the time we were banning fraction and split. We're like, let's just have 5 maps. And we could play in a tournament. So we practiced for 2 weeks, and then we played the first night, or we practiced for we did tryouts for like 3 more days, and then we found Sim, and we were like, let's go. We're gonna go with Sim. He's been the most talented one that we've tried. And then we had like a week and a half of practice where we were doing like 5 scrims a day and just trying to get some like teamwork, some chemistry, and we were reviewing it and correcting. And we played the first nights weekly, and we won that. And then we played the Boom TV 5K qualifier. And we won that. And then that leads us into the 20K. And then things started to get a little bit more serious, because I was actually taking individual trials while this was going on. And it was getting harder and harder for me to want to take those trials, because I could see us improving every day. And the bridge between, or I guess the gap between the teams that were in the like 20 to 30 range and us was getting closer every day. And the moment I saw that, I was like, well, what's the point? What's the point of playing for like a team in the top 20, or like playing for a team that's like anywhere between 20 and 25? What's the point of me playing with that team when I have a team that could beat them today and tomorrow and the next day, and we could repeat it and we're improving? Because you can sit here and be like, oh, a paycheck's nice, but like at the end of the day, I'm not playing for a paycheck. I'm playing because I want to compete. I want to actually like play and win at the end of the day. I don't want to sit here and be like, oh, my team was ranked 20th and I made $8,000 a month or so, or like being able to say like I made over 100K playing gaming, but like I never did anything. That's how pro career or careers die. It's when players just never win. So it got harder and harder for me to take those choices, until I got to the point where I was like, you know what, guys? If we all commit to making this the best that we can possibly make, and that's where I started to take the footsteps into leading the culture. I was like, if we can do this consistently, I'll say no to everybody, because I think we can take them.
Very cool. Very cool. So, going into this latest Nerd Street Gamer tournament, did you guys, I mean, obviously it sounds like you guys were very focused on just making those improvements game to game, round to round, match to match, all of that. But did you have any public expectations for this tournament, or maybe just private expectations for the tournament?
Yeah, we definitely had private expectations more so than public ones. I think publicly, everybody likes to see a free agent team do well. So we're like, publicly, there's no pressure, but privately, we're operating. Bank has rent to pay, and he's currently paying that rent with our winnings. And that means we have to win in order for the project to continue going. And I'm kind of in the same boat as him, where it's like I have rent to pay, I have my own expenses, I have food, like cost of living is high. So it's like I need to find a way to subsidize that, so at least like I don't drain the savings. I can just slowly trickle it away to buy me enough time to get a new opportunity. So privately going into it, we were expecting ourselves to win. We've been practicing a lot, and we have kind of been gauging our results in practice and going, okay, we're within like this range. We're in like the 10 to 20 range in our minds. We're like, we deserve to be there. We're like, we can do this. So when we're playing the Nerd Street and we're like seeing even the bracket we got, I think we got the hardest side of the bracket, because we had to take out T1, Acru, potentially TSM, and then Complexity. So we had the hardest side of the bracket, and the entire time our mentality was, well, we'd have to beat them sooner or later, so why not just do it now? Like, there's no reason to be afraid of it. So we just held ourselves to that standard, and we focused on all the reasons why we failed in the previous ones. That was our main focus. We're like, if we aren't good enough and we get outclassed, like we get outplayed, that's an acceptable way to lose. But if we lose because of this crap that we did these last two tournaments, that's unacceptable. And happy to say that we did not let that bother us throughout the entire tournament, and we ended up coming out with a dub. So privately, we upheld our expectations.
Was there a moment or after a certain match in that tournament, like maybe after you guys beat T1 or something, where you were like, "Oh, we will actually win this tournament," or was it more of like you guys won the finals and then you're like, "Well, holy shit, we actually won this tournament."
I think that round was actually during T1 with the first map, where the last round against T1, or because T1 started to make a comeback where they kind of just held a default for like 45 seconds to a minute. Later. It was a very long time, and they were like, they're trying to ice us, which is they're trying to get us to make the mistakes of walking into them while they're just laser focused on punishing us and trying to claw their way back into it. And they did, I think they got like 7 rounds on us doing it. And that was where we're slow to adapt. We really gotta amp it up here. So the last round of the game, I stayed in hookah with a judge for the entire round. I did not move. And my team was telling me, just like, contain the space, contain the space. We got it. We're gonna push them to you. Do not worry. And it was that moment where we all just trusted each other in the game plan, and we didn't make any deviations. And then they eventually came to hookah. I just one pumped them each with the judge. And it was that when it's like, we're listening to each other, we're trusting each other, we made some mistakes, but we're not letting the mistakes be the reason we're gonna lose. And after that map, I was 100% confident throughout the entire rest. Even after losing a map to a crew, I was like, we're still going to win this because we're playing together as a team, where it doesn't matter if one person has 25 kills, the other person has 5. I think even against a crew, I got hit with that. I think I had 22 kills in a best of 3 series, which is the worst performance individually that I've had ever. And we won the maps, and we won them convincingly. And it was that moment where I was like, this team does not need individual performances to win. We just have to trust each other and play together, and we will win. And it's those moments that just keeps reassuring me that we're going to succeed in the future, because our baseline for performance play is just good. It's just basic teamwork. Individual performances do not matter.
Yeah, sorry. It was 6 rounds. 6 rounds that T1 put together in a
Oh, it
streak
was six,
before you
yeah.
guys. Do you think that there is a quality that, in general, tier two teams have that is advantageous compared to the signed tier one teams, like the T1s, the TSMs? The thing that I think about, and I don't know if it's accurate, it might not be, but it's thinking of Rocky IV, where he's out in the woods training, and then he's going against Drago, who's got like this fully teched out facility with a bunch of scientists. And there's something about like the grit and the hunger that let's Rocky end up beating that, even though he doesn't have the same like support structure or infrastructure, or and this is perfectly valid as well. Or is it like, no, having money just helps. Having like coach and support staff and analysts and a place to train, that just helps. And I don't know what's going on with these tier one teams.
Yeah, I think the financial support helps because it allows you to no longer feel burdened by outside factors. But I think what happens to a lot of players on tier one teams that have such like they have this financial support, they have the managers, the coaches, is complacency. They start to look and they go, I deserve to be here. And they start to believe that they are truly better than what they are. And it's where personal ego kind of comes in, because you're playing a game where personal skill does come into play. But something that the tier two scene has is resilience. And they understand, in my opinion, they understand that set structure is good when you have when you have it for the appropriate situations. Or I think a lot of tier one teams have so much structure that they become complacent in what they're doing, because they're doing it out of repetition, but not because it's actually applicable to the situation. When you're a free agent or a tier two team, you're playing a lot more loose, so you're way more open to doing a lot crazier things. I think it's a double-edged sword. You're a lot more open to doing crazier things because you have less to lose, and you haven't been shown the value that structure can bring. But that is going to catch a lot of people off guard who are running structure for the sake of running something that they're familiar with rather than running it for when it's good. You'll see that a lot with tier one teams, where they'll just run setups and you'll be like, why are they doing that? Or why are they reacting this way? And I think a lot of it has to come down to they're running it because they've ran it 100 times in practice. So that's the first thing their brain goes to. And if it works in practice, their brain is also going to tell them that, like, hey, it's the right thing to do because it's worked before when we saw like a couple of these things. But they're not really critically thinking about how the game's playing. Or sometimes I think players don't think enough for themselves, where a lot of coaches and analysts will develop a game plan and bring it to you. And there's nothing wrong with that. But when you keep getting handed a game plan, you're conditioning yourself to stop thinking as much about what's actually happening in the game. And therefore, your decision-making is going to be more and more questionable as time goes on, because you're no longer being the proactive player. You're kind of just reaping the benefits of an organization without really playing at the level of said organization.
Yeah, I know that on Valoranting, we've discussed this idea of, like, you know, Hiko's a great player, really incredible career, but it must be interesting to be Hiko and see what you're getting paid to play really, really hard, to come up with strats, to communicate, to do all these things, and then to be like, man, you know, streaming and making more money or the same amount of money is a lot more fun and my schedule is a lot more free. And, you know, the question of, like, how much that can affect someone is interesting. But I'm not expecting you to comment on Hiko or anything. So obviously you've kind of peppered this throughout, but it sounds like the future for Nearest Airport is getting signed as a full team to a, hopefully, really attractive, you know, team contract and salary. Obviously, there can be hard decisions about, like, individual players maybe getting poached or given opportunities. Do you guys have a structure around how you guys are going to deal with that, or if, like, some offer comes in, it's only for some players, or offer comes in and it's for a single player? Have you guys discussed that and what that looks like?
Yeah. We are currently completely off limits towards poaching, because I think at this point, not just me, but everybody on my team has understood that our success comes from the camaraderie and the culture that we have created. It doesn't come from individual talent. It doesn't come from some person just constantly popping off or having good performances. If you, I think if you look at the statistics for our last tournament, everybody had a good rating. Everybody popped off in different matches. It wasn't one person consistently throughout the entire time. So and this is something that I started learning, because again, I took some individual trials in the beginning, and I started to realize that other players don't have, or other teams that are anywhere between 10 and 20, because I trialed for some of those that are currently in there, they don't have the culture. They don't have the environment. They're still working on that. They just have talented players, but they haven't figured out how to make those players work together for various reasons. So when you look at our team, it's like we not only have talented players, but we have the culture and the camaraderie and the environment already on the lockdown. And I think in the future, it's only gonna, it, for us, it's a matter of time for when, because we're gonna continue playing in tournaments. And I truly believe that we're gonna continue to be dominant due to the factors that we have this on lockdown. And it's only a matter of time before one org who already has a team gets fed up with how much they're paying their players to continuously just have terrible performances, or an org that's been on the stand or the like sidelines who's been watching the scene for a while jumps in and takes notice. Because currently, this will be me tooting the horn for my own team, but we are the only unsigned team in the last year and a half of Valorant to break into the top 20. Not having to play in a VCT qualifier. We are the only unsigned team to do that. And now, even now, we are an unsigned team ranked at the 17th spot in North America. We are 30 points away from being ranked 14th in North America. And I think we have very good odds of making close. And I think if we do make close, we will see an org pull the trigger on us. Because that's what all of these orgs are already investing for. They want somebody to make the close qualifier. And if one of those spots goes to an unsigned team who doesn't have a coach, who has literally no financial support or standings at all, that's going to be impressive. So that's what we're aiming for. And there goes my
No worries, no worries. To build off of that, I wanted to like let you kind of, if you wanted to, just like stare directly into the camera and be like, "Here's my message to anyone looking to find the next best Valorant team." Like, do you have a message that you would want to get out to any organizations, like looking around?
Yeah, I could. this I kind of did it a little bit in my tweet last night, but essentially, this is a PSA for any org that is currently looking or who's been on the sidelines, who wants a team that is hungry to win, wants a team that is capable of winning, and wants a team that understands the correct culture that is needed in a environment of just a team-based environment. We are that team. And it's time to pull the strings. I think there's a lot of different orgs that have been waiting and have been looking, and we're only going to keep going further and further. And I truly believe that because what other team has gone from unrated to 17th in a month and a half? There hasn't been.
And also, right now we're cheap, but if we get into close qualifiers, you're going to pay out the nose.
I don't even think it's like that. I've talked to our guys about that. It's not like for us, it's not about the price tag. We just, if you relieve the burden that comes with just like daily financial responsibilities, we just want to be able to make this the full time, to be able to fully commit all of our resources into this for the longevable future. Because that's the only uncertain point. And for me right now, it's a matter of time. So if playing in these NSGs and these weeklies buy us more time, we're going to continue to do that. And then especially with VCT coming up, it's a matter of time. We perform well in VCT, I'm sure we'll have multiple different people knocking on our doors. Because right now the spotlight is on us, and I think everybody, including the orgs, are waiting to see what we're going to do next.
Awesome. Final question is, do you have a question that you wish I asked you?
No, I actually think you covered all of the questions from my like past history to my individual life to everything that Nearest Airport has accomplished to my teammates. If there is one thing, last thing that I can like say, it would just be this. I want to thank everybody who's been super supportful of the Tier 2 scene. I want to thank you guys for giving me this opportunity to kind of share a little bit about our experience and who we are with essentially the world. And a shout out to my teammates. I do not emphasize this enough, but they saved me as a player. There were so many things that I didn't understand about just camaraderie and teamwork that these guys have taught me. And they've taken my probably darkest time in my career, and they've turned it into one of my brightest ones. And I didn't do that individually. My teammates quite literally saved my career, and I can't thank them enough for that. So I want to give them that little highlight so that they know that I freaking love those guys.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to do this. We will be doing like an excerpt of this that will go on the show Tuesday. And then we'll probably take the full interview, edit it down to some amount, and then it'll be posted on YouTube. I'll let you know when that happens and everything. But unless you have any other questions or concerns for me, we'll call this good.
No, thank you again. Just once again, thank you for the opportunity to share this with you guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time out and best of luck in the future.
Thank you. Have a fantastic rest of your day.
You too, bye.
Bye.